negotiate a peace between the Otoes and the Omahas. Lewis explained that since the Omahas were out hunting and the expedition must press on, it would be impossible for him to arrange a peace. Then the chief spoke. Big Horse pointed out the obvious, that he had come to the camp naked, and expressed his fear that he would return home naked. Peace was all very well, he said, but if there were peace, where would the young men go to get their goods? If the captains wanted the Otoes at peace, Big Horse pointed out, he could arrange it as long as he had something to give to his young men at home. Whiskey would be the most effective peacemaker. The captains were not going to give Big Horse or any other Indian a barrel of whiskey. They did hand out tobacco, paint, and beads. These gifts made little impression on the chiefs or their warriors. The captains then tried handing around printed certificates proclaiming the bearer to be a friend and ally of the United States. These trifles did not answer either. One disgusted warrior disdainfully handed back his certificate. The captains, angered by this disrespect toward an official document, rebuked the man very roughly. There were bad feelings all around. To dissipate them and to impress the Indians with their powers, the captains gave the chiefs and warriors a dram of whiskey each and brought out their magic show, including the air gun, a magnifying glass that could concentrate the sun's rays to start a fire in a bit of dry grass, the telescope, and other items. But the Otoes had not come to be awed. They had come for goods. They had imagined wonderful giveaways of valuable items from the apparently endless supply on the keelboat, and what they got was some tobacco and a piece of paper. They went away unhappy. Still, Little Thief indicated that he would go to Washington in the spring, so Lewis's and Clark's first venture as frontier diplomats had some success. The Otoes were a tribe that had once been mighty, but were now greatly reduced by the smallpox. Woefully inferior to the Sioux, in morale as well as numbers, they were not the Indians to try to use force to make the captains hand out the goods. With the Sioux, just upriver, things might well be different. Sergeant Charles Floyd had been desperately ill the past few days. Lewis had diagnosed his disease as bilious colic, or bilious colic, and had nothing effective to treat it with. But then neither did Dr. Rush back in Philadelphia. On August 20th, Floyd died, most likely from peritonitis resulting from an infected appendix that had perforated or ruptured. Sergeant Floyd was the first U.S. soldier to die west of the Mississippi. The expedition carried his body to a high, round hill overlooking an unnamed river. The captains had him buried with all the honors of war and fixed a red cedar post over the grave with his name and title and the date. Captain Lewis read the funeral service over him. Clark provided a fitting epitaph in his journal. "This man at all times gave us proofs of his firmness and determined resolution to do service to his country and honor to himself." The captains concluded the proceedings by naming the river Floyd's River and the bluff Sergeant Floyd's Bluff. 2 days and 41 miles later, the captains ordered an election for Floyd's replacement. Private Patrick Gass got 19 votes, while Privates William Bratton and George Gibson split the remainder. This was the first election ever held west of the Mississippi. On August 26th, Lewis issued general orders appointing Patrick Gass to the rank of Sergeant in the Corps of Volunteer for Northwestern Discovery, the first time he used such a phrase. He praised Gass for his previous faithful service and concluded, "The commanding officers are still further confirmed in the high opinion they had previously formed of the capacity, diligence, and integrity of Sergeant Gass, from the wish expressed by a large majority of his comrades for his appointment as sergeant." That same day, Private George Shannon, youngest member of the party, failed to come up after a day of hunting. Nor did he report in the next day or the day after. The captains grew concerned, not about desertion — evidently, Shannon gave them no uneasiness on that score — but about possible Indian trouble or a hunting accident. They sent Private John Coulter out looking for Shannon, but he had no luck. They sent Driard to look, but after searching through the night of August 26 to 27, he too reported failure. Reed dismissed in disgrace. Sergeant Floyd dead. Shannon missing. The expedition was almost 10% reduced in fighting strength as it moved toward the heart of Sioux territory. But hope, rather than fear, was the main emotion felt by the captains as they entered Sioux country. This was the one tribe singled out for specific mention by Jefferson in his orders. It controlled the river and had turned back previous traders coming up from St. Louis, and it was the largest of the tribes. Lewis hoped to make the Sioux the centerpiece of the vast American trading empire he was trying to establish, and he thought this was such a good deal for the Sioux that they couldn't say no. On August 27th, as the keelboat approached today's Yankton, South Dakota, Old Dorion informed the captains that they were now in the territory of the Yankton Sioux, with whom he had lived for many years. Lewis ordered the prairie set afire as a signal to the Yanktons, inviting them to a council. A few hours later, as the boat passed the mouth of the James River, a teenage Yankton boy swam out to one of the pirogues. He gestured that he wished to talk. The expedition put ashore. Two more teenagers appeared. Through Mr. Dorion, they said a large band of Yanktons were camped nearby. The captains delegated Sergeant Pryor, a voyager, and Mr. Dorion to go to the camp and invite the chiefs to come to council at Calumet Bluffs, near present Gavin's Point Dam, on the Nebraska side. On August 29th, the expedition was in camp at Calumet Bluffs. As they waited for the Yanktons to come to council, they worked. Tracks along the riverbank had led Lewis to conclude that Shannon was ahead of them, but thinking himself behind, so Shannon was pressing on to catch up to the expedition that was behind him. Lewis detailed a soldier to go look for Shannon. Reflecting his worry, Lewis told the private to take along some extra rations for Shannon, who might well be starving. He was not considered to be one of the expedition's better hunters. Captain Clark put some men to work making a tow rope of elk skin, then sat at his field desk, dipped his quill into the inkstand, and began to write some remarks for the Yanktons. At 4 o'clock p.m., Mr. Dorion showed up on the opposite bank at the head of a party of some 70 Yankton warriors. The Indians went into camp, while Dorion and Sergeant Pryor crossed over on a canoe sent by the captains. Pryor reported that the Yanktons were extremely friendly, had even tried to carry him into their camp on a painted buffalo robe, thinking he was the leader of the expedition. He said the camp was handsome, made of buffalo skins painted different color, all compact and handsomely arranged. Their camps formed of a conic form, containing about 12 or 15 persons each, and 40 in number. Sergeant Pryor had just become the first American to describe the classic Plains teepee. The Yanktons had cooked a fat dog for a feast. Pryor thought it good and well-flavored. They had provided him with a snug apartment for to lodge. The plains through which he had marched, Pryor said, were covered with game. The captains had presents packed into one of the canoes to send over to the Yanktons. They put in tobacco, corn, and some iron kettles, and told Pryor and Dorion to ask the Indians to cross over in the morning for a council. At 10 o'clock a.m., the captain sent a canoe to bring over the Indians. They had signified the importance of this first meeting with one of the Sioux bands by putting on their dress uniforms and putting up a flagstaff near a large oak, running up the flag, and firing the bow swivel gun. The Yanktons had a sense of drama, too. They were in full regalia. As they came up from the riverbank, the chiefs were preceded by four musicians, singing and playing as they made their way to the flagstaff. The soldiers made ritual payments of tobacco to the musicians. The conferees shook hands and sat down. With Dorion interpreting, Lewis gave his basic Indian speech. When he finished, the chief said they would respond in the morning. Obviously, they would need time to confer on this business of accepting a new father and becoming part of a new trade system. Lewis recognized that patience was not just a virtue in dealing with Indians, it was a necessity, and handed out medals to five chiefs. He pronounced a chief named Wiuchi the first chief, by what authority, on what basis cannot be said, and gave him a red-laced military coat, a military cocked hat, and an American flag. Lewis did all this with the utmost seriousness. It never occurred to him that his actions might be characterized as patronizing, dictatorial, ridiculous, and highly dangerous. From what he knew from Old Dorion, these Yanktons were peaceable, at least compared with their neighbors and relatives, the Teton Sioux, farther upriver. But his idea of how to make them into allies was to give them worthless medals and wardrobe trappings rather than the guns and powder they needed. and to make one chief the big chief was to meddle in intertribal politics about which he knew nothing. In general, it would be impossible to say which side was more ignorant of the other. The desire for friendship overrode ignorance. The men of the expedition had come to the northern plains as outsiders, but as James Rhonda writes, that night the explorers became part of a prairie community. After the council, Indian boys showed off their skill with bows and arrows to the delight of the soldiers, who handed out prizes of beads. At dusk, three fires were built in the center of camp. Indians in gaudy paint came leaping into the firelight to sing of their great feats in battle and in the chase. They danced to music coming from deer hoof rattles and a drum. Sergeant Ordway recorded that the warriors began with a hoop and hollow and ended with the same. An individual would sing of what he had done in his day and what warlike actions he had done. This they call merit. They would confess how many horses they had stole. At Dorion's suggestion, the soldiers threw the dancers gifts of tobacco, knives, and bells. Captain Clark was impressed. "The Sioux," he wrote, "is a stout, bold-looking people, the young men handsome, and well-made. The warriors are very much decorated with paint, porcupine, quills, and feathers, large leggings and moccasins, all with buffalo robes of different colors. The squaws wore petticoats and white buffalo robes with the black hair turned back over their necks and shoulders." That was the first American description of the ceremonial dress of the Plains Indians. The captains were doing path-breaking ethnology. Clark wrote, "I will here remark a society which I had never before this day heard was in any nation of Indians." It was a group of Indian warriors who had taken a vow never to give back, let the danger be what it may. That refusal to retreat had cost the society dreadfully. In the past year, 18 of the 22 members had been killed. Clark was impressed by the survivors. "They stay by themselves, fond of mirth and assume a degree of superiority. Stout, likely fellows." Ethnology, however, was very much secondary to establishing the American system along the Missouri. What the Indians looked like was entertaining. What the chief said about Lewis's proposals was critical. In the morning, the chiefs gave their reply. Wiuchi spoke first. His refrain was, "We are poor and have no powder and ball. Our women has got no clothes." But if Mr. Dorion were with him, he would go to Washington in the spring. Welcome news. The other chiefs then spoke. They suffered from stage fright. "I am young and can't speak," Struck by the Panna confessed. "I am a young man and inexperienced, cannot say much," White Crane Man explained. But they all managed to make it clear that what they wanted was powder and ball, and perhaps some whiskey. Clark and Lewis could not meet those needs. They could do one thing all the chiefs wanted: leave Mr. Dorion with them for the winter. He could arrange peace with other tribes and organize an expedition of chiefs to go to Washington in the spring. The captains gave each chief a carrot of tobacco and Mr. Dorion a bottle of whiskey and had the Indians ferried across the river to their camp on the other side. Thus, the first encounter with the band of Sioux ended on a hopeful note, despite Yankton's disappointment with the presents received. The last chief to speak, Arkawichar, had also apologized. "I do not speak very well. I am a poor man." But if he did not speak well, he spoke with the voice of a prophet. "It was all very well for the Yanktons to open their ears," he said, "and I think our old friend Mr. Dorion can open the ears of the other bands of Sioux. But I fear those nations above will not open their ears, and you cannot, I fear, open them." Arkawichar spoke not only prophetically but bluntly. He said the captains had given the Indians 5 medals. "I wish you to give 5 kegs of powder with them." The captains did not, could not comply. As Arkawichar had warned them, where they were going, they would need all their powder. Chapter 14. Encounter with the Sioux, September 1804. In the first 2 weeks of September, the expedition gradually entered the country where the short grass prairie of the drier high plains predominated. The wildlife became even more abundant than below. There were herds of elk in every copse of woods along the riverbank. Deer were as plentiful as birds. Buffalo became a common sight. The man pointed out a goat which no one could identify, but no one could catch either. Captain Clark pronounced the plums the most delicious he had ever tasted, the grapes plenty and finely flavored. On the third, the captain sent Coulter to chase Shannon again. 2 days later, tracks along the riverbank indicated that Coulter was still trying to catch up and that Shannon had lost one of the two horses he had with him. Private John Shields came in from a hunt to report another wonder, a deer with a black tail. Lewis saw more wild goats on a hill, but they ran off before he could even describe their color. The hunters brought in 3 bucks and 2 elk. Moving the keelboat and pirogues upriver required a tremendous effort from each man. Consequently, they ate prodigiously. In comparison with beef, the venison and elk were lean, even at this season. Each soldier consumed up to 9 pounds of meat per day, along with whatever fruit the area afforded and some cornmeal, and still felt hungry. On September 7th, in present Boyd County, Nebraska, the captains took a stroll. To their astonishment, they found themselves in the middle of an extensive village of small mammals that lived in tunnels in the ground. Here, there, everywhere around them, the little mammals would pop up, sit up on their hind legs, and chatter. The captains brought some men to the site and tried to dig to the bottom of one of the tunnels, but after digging 6 feet and running a pole down the rest, they discovered they were not halfway to the animal's bed. They had 5 barrels of water fetched to the site and poured into a tunnel, which forced one animal out. He was killed and brought back to the keelboat so that a proper description could be written. The voyagers informed the captains that these animals were petit chien, or prairie dogs. The animal was new to science. The captains gave the prairie dog his first formal description. On September 8th, Clark went ashore to look for goats, with no success. Lewis went hunting, and on that day killed his first buffalo. Altogether, the hunters brought in that evening 2 buffalo, 1 large elk, 1 elk fawn, 3 deer, 3 wild turkeys, and a squirrel. The following day, Lewis again went hunting, this time with Private Reuben Field along, and shot another buffalo. Field got one too, as did Clark. Driard killed 3 deer. York killed a buffalo at the invitation of his master. The captains were amazed to see 500 buffalo in one herd grazing near the river. On September 11th, as the keelboat moved past a bend in the river, the bowman spotted Shannon sitting by the bank. The keelboat came to and Shannon came aboard. He was extremely weak, indeed nearly starved to death. As his comrades gave him jerked meat, he related his story. He had been sure the boat was ahead, so he had been chasing it for 16 days. For the past 12 days, he had been without bullets. During that time, he had managed to kill one rabbit by shooting a long, hard, straight stick in place of a bullet. Otherwise, he had lived for nearly 2 weeks on grapes and plums. He had finally concluded that he was too weak ever to catch up with the keelboat and had decided to sit by the riverbank and hope for a trading boat coming down from the Mandan villages headed toward St. Louis. He had saved his horse as his last resort. Clark was astounded that a man had liked to have starved to death in a land of plenty for the want of bullets or something to kill his meat. On the 14th, Clark killed a goat. Lewis weighed, measured, and described it, the first scientific description of the pronghorn, or antelope, as it is usually but wrongly called. That afternoon, Private Shields brought in a hare of the prairie, giving Lewis a second opportunity in a single day to measure and describe a new species, in this case, the white-tailed jackrabbit. Intrigued by the animal, Lewis went looking for the jackrabbit in its native habitat a couple of days later. He found one, chased it, and made notes. It resorts to the open plains, is extremely fleet, and never burrows or takes shelter in the ground when pursued. I measured the leaps of one which I surprised in the plains and found them 21 feet. They appear to run with more ease and to bound with greater agility than any animal I ever saw. That is one of 3 Lewis documents written between September 14th and 17th, 1804. They constitute almost all of his known writings for a full year. This adds to the mystery of the lost or never written Journals of Meriwether Lewis. The passage quoted above comes from Lewis's field notes, which exist but in an obviously incomplete form. All his celestial measurements, hundreds and hundreds of them, are preserved. But there are only two journal entries, one on the 16th and the next on the 17th of September, 1804. The way they are written indicates that he almost had to have been writing regularly. There is no introduction, no "sorry I've been away, here is what has happened since last I wrote" quality whatsoever to the entries. He picks up, apparently, at where he left off the previous evening and gives every sense at the conclusion of his second entry that more will follow in the morning. But until new journal entries are discovered, their existence remains speculative. Writing as a biographer rather than an archivist or a historian, that is, on the basis of the internal evidence of the September entries, I am convinced that there once existed, and still may, an important body of Lewis journal entries. The pain of the loss is doubled by the quality of what Lewis wrote that September. He walks you through his day and lets you see through his eyes. What he saw, no American had ever seen before, and only a few would see in the future. This morning set out at an early hour. Lewis opened the entry for Sunday, September 16th. Come to at 1:30 after 7 a.m. on the Lard. Shore 1¼ miles above the mouth of a small creek which we named Corvus, in consequence of having killed a beautiful bird of that genus near it. The captains decided to lie by for 2 days, to dry the baggage and to lighten the keelboat by transferring a part of her load